is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And that was Elvis Presley's song, It Feels So Right. His lyrics, It Feels so right, how can it be so wrong? A sentiment we'll now be talking about in the space of charity. And we'll be talking with someone who believes that what feels so right is often so wrong. Bob Lupton is the author of Toxic Charity, How Churches and Charities Hurt Those Who Help and How to Reverse It, a book that shook much of the charitable world into reevaluating their efforts. And today he's with us to talk about his recent follow-on book, Charity Detox, What Charity Would Look Like If We Cared About Results. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Bob, tell us John Perkins' story, how it shaped your and your family's story. I think that's the way to best start off this hour. And that was a story about an experience that you're now bringing to this important discussion.
Well, John Perkins is a kind of my mentor. He's a third grade dropout, grew up in Mississippi, sharecropping back well before integration. He's in his 80s now. But John was nearly killed in the civil rights movement and barely escaped Mississippi, went to California, and then had a life-changing experience that convinced him to come back to Mississippi and commit himself to developing a young generation of young leaders who would take their place in helping the poor of that area. John was and still is an inspiration to me. He believes, as I do now, that living among those you serve is clearly the most effective way of breaking the poverty cycle and transforming communities. So it's because of John's influence that I made the decision to move with my family into inner city Atlanta, where I have been serving and trying to make a difference for nearly four decades now.
Well, you know, one of the things that you learned from John's experience was that while he was working with these young people, they would often leave after he helped them and leave the very communities that they were a resource to and for. Talk about that.
Well, I saw the same thing in Atlanta. For about 10 years, I commuted into the inner city from the suburbs and did a lot of work with young people and families, helping them to get out of very bad situations, move out of the projects to better neighborhoods, which was very good for them. But what eventually dawned on me was that as each one of those rising stars left, the community was poorer and a more hopeless, desperate place to live. So what was helping individuals was harming the neighborhoods that we were also trying to help. So John's experience is my experience is certainly mirrored in John's.
You know, there's a pretty remarkable, this is a segue of sorts, but we did an hour on Buck O'Neill. I don't know if you know Buck O'Neill's story, but he was the manager of the Kansas City Monarchs in the Black Baseball League, and ultimately became the first Major League Baseball manager as an African American. A remarkable story. We found an interview where he was talking about what the old black neighborhoods in the South were like. Now, there was segregation and it was terrible. But what Buck was also saying was when all those black folks left those cities and left those towns and took their store ownership talents and all their talents and fled off to better neighborhoods or different neighborhoods, that it really killed the neighborhoods they'd left behind. Talk a little about that.
Well, yeah, and that same thing has happened in throughout the country. Certainly, Atlanta's been my primary experience, base of operation, and those inner city neighborhoods never have recovered from the out-migration of their more capable neighbors that brought some good stability and education and decent jobs and good models, all of that to their communities. When segregation was in place, they were segregated places, But in the advent of the civil rights movement, that opened up opportunities for families to move out of those inner city communities, and the more capable did move out, and they have many of those communities have never recovered from that.
No doubt. And of course, we're not ever even suggesting that you want to go back to segregation, but there were some incredible positive impact, but the negative impact was that folks just they left. And yep. let's talk about helpful versus hurtful charity. Talk about those two things.
Well, certainly helpful charity is what enables people to first of all get out of emergency situation. There's certainly emergency care that is needed, but most of the needs in our society are a function of chronic poverty. A series of decisions have been made. And so what chronic poverty needs is a development response. In other words, a pathway to help folks move, take measured steps to move out of their poverty situation into self-sufficiency. What becomes hurtful is when organizations, churches, nonprofits, and others continue to give emergency support to folks that are in a chronic poverty situation. In other words, that's what ultimately produces dependency. And when you give well-intended contributions, clothes, food, and others, to folks that are not in an emergency situation, there are unintended consequences. People, the work ethic is eroded. People's dependency increases. Obsessive dignity diminishes. And so what is intended to be helpful and good ends up being hurtful to the very folks we were wanting to help.
This is Lee Habib, and we're listening to Bob Lupton, Charity Detox. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we continue now with Bob Lupton. And he wrote the book, Toxic Charity, How Churches and Charities Hurt Those Who Help and How to Reverse It, a book that so shook much of the charitable world that many of them had to reevaluate their efforts. And today he's with us to talk about his recent follow-on book, Charity Detox, What Charity Would Look Like If We Cared About Results. I wanted to have you, Bob, talk about a little contrast in studies of what worked in one place and what might not have worked. And in Charity Detox, you tell us the powerful story of a contrast in one neighborhood, Knoxville, Tennessee. Tell us that story.
Well, there's a very fine rescue mission in Knoxville that had been sheltering homeless men, women, and families for many years. And like most shelters, they provided free beds, free clothing, and a safe place to sleep at night. They caught this idea that perhaps their residents, they were overlooking some of the talents and abilities of their residents, and began exploring if they engaged their residents in work while they were there, making beds, mopping floors, working in the laundry, that wouldn't be a cruel thing. Actually, it would be communicating to them, you have something of real value that you can bring to the table. And no one is so poor that they have nothing to bring to the table. And so they began that process, and it absolutely turned around their model. Today they have several businesses operating out of the shelter. Every person who makes the decision to come and stay in their program gets a caseworker, and And they measure their success by not the numbers of people that fill their beds or the number of meals that they serve, but the number of folks who actually move out of poverty, that become independent, that have their own apartment, that are working full-time jobs, that are paying off bad debts, that are reconciling with their families, et cetera, et cetera. And so that number of folks that are successful are a good bit smaller than the large numbers, the hundreds that did fill their beds, but the outcomes are dramatically different. So they switched from measuring activities to actually measuring outcomes, and it just made all the difference in the world. Now you compare what they are doing to what's happening outside their facility under the large viaduct where the expressway goes over. That's considered Charity Central, and that's where all the homeless gather for free food and handouts that charitable folks, churches, and others bring in there and distribute to the poor. And that creates all manner of chaos in the community. So you've got one charity model that is frankly destructive not only to the community but to the recipients, and then right beside it a model that is actually developing people and moving them out of poverty. Quite a contrast.
And I think, you know, if you think it through, and I've often pondered this, but I think people of faith actually have to think about this in many respects differently than people who are secular. And that is that if you think everyone's a child of God and you think everyone has capacities, then your job is to figure out and help them unearth them. And dependency on me is not the question. It's more dependency on God that becomes the question.
Yep.
And so, let's, you know, there's a quote that I wanted to read you. You said, "I believe now, as I did when I wrote the first Toxic Charity, that the only effective charity is the kind that asks more from those who are being served, not less." And then you got into feed a person once, it elicits appreciation. Feed him twice, it creates anticipation. Feed him three times, it creates expectation. Feed him four times, it creates entitlement. Feed him five times, it produces dependency. Talk about that. I think that's one of the more profound things I've read in a long time. And work it through with me where you came up with that.
Well, I've seen that process, have participated in that process. It's a downward spiral that repeats itself over and over again. It's the result of people with good hearts and good motivations thinking that one-way giving to people in need somehow produces good results. And those, if you live in that environment for any length of time at all, you see that there is a downward spiral that almost always ends in dependency. And so there's a reason why the poor remain poor in our culture. For all of the good that we do, the tons and tons of food and clothing that we collect and distribute to the poor of our nation, you would think that for all of that activity, the poor would be less poor today. But in fact, that poverty needle has not moved in a positive direction. As a matter of fact, it has moved in a negative direction. And I think that it is because we've been giving from the motivation of the heart, but we have not been engaging our minds in the process of giving. So that's what Toxic Charity and Charity Detox have been calling for. Let's engage our minds and look for different outcomes to what our charity is intended to do.
And you know, you also are not shy about looking into the Christian missionary industrial complex, as you like to call it. What's your beef with Christian missionaries? And by the way, I've had these discussions with many a group that I think are actually providing a what we all call the law of unintended consequences, which is getting the actual opposite result of the thing you desired.
Yeah. Well, the mission trip industry is a very, very big industry these days. We send out about 2 million short-term missionaries every year at a cost of somewhere between $3 and $4 billion. So it's a very big industry. But if you look at the actual outcomes of that, it's more about us and our feeling good than it is about actually helping those we go and serve.
Well, and there was one example in the book where used clothing imports, for instance, caused a 50% increase in unemployment in the African textile industry from 1981 to 2000. And this is because all the, well, I would call them naive missionaries bring in caseloads and boatloads of free clothes, thus destroying
exactly
an actual industry that creates jobs. And between 1992 and 2006, 500,000 workers in Nigeria lost their jobs due to the inflow of donated clothing. We're talking to Bob Lupton. We're interviewing him on his new book, Charity Detox. And, well, if you want to hear any of this and you want to hear more about what we do and the stories we bring to you, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. And, Bob, you know, what do you say to this? Like this clothing example that I cite from your book, what do you say to folks?
When I have the opportunity to speak with groups that are doing this kind of global outreach, there are a few principles that I lay out to them. Sometimes they don't want to hear it. But one of the things I say is do not give anything away. When you take in suitcases full of clothing and shoes and giveaway items, it again creates unhealthy dependency. It erodes the economy that is already there. In developing countries, most folk are making their living through little micro enterprises. They're making little pottery and baskets and other kinds of things that they sell to tourists along the road. So they eke out a living that way. Well, when the tour bus comes rumbling up the road, those folks that have a stand near the bus stop, they get all excited because this is business coming.
Yep. Yep. This is Lee Habib, and this is Bob Lupton we're talking to. His book, Charity Detox. When we come back, more in-depth storytelling from Bob. And by the way, it'll hopefully make you think about how you think about your charitable giving. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and we're continuing our interview with Bob Lupton and his new book, Charity Detox. What charity would look like if we cared about results. Ouch. I think sometimes we just don't want to think about it, Bob. I mean, I think sometimes it's that we're not thoughtful enough, and that we want to, I think, as you put it before in the last segment, feel better for ourselves, thinking that we've done either God's work or we've done good, and then we can check that box off and we can move on to the next thing. I wanted to share one other thing that you had written that was really remarkable to me. A Texas church went to Nicaragua, built a bunch of houses that the poor then sold when they left. The cash was more valuable to them, and they were used to sleeping in bad conditions. So you say focus on activities versus outcomes. Talk about that.
Well, the Texas group that built the houses, it was a wonderful endeavor. They saw these folks that were living and raising their families in the dump in Managua. You know, they're filthy and following the garbage trucks around, and they were so moved by that that they decided they would do something. So they purchased land and built homes for these families, almost a little village on the countryside that had their own plot of land and clean air. And of course, it was great celebration when the folks moved into their little houses. But a year later, all of those folks had sold those homes and moved back to the dump. They were not farmers. They were recyclers, and they had been recycling materials, usable materials, for generations. And so it's a question of listening more carefully to the needs of those we would serve rather than in bringing in our own ideas of what people need.
Well, we've described some of the problems, and it's the problem with the givers more than the acceptors. So how do we who give become better givers, and how do we become better missionaries and better people of faith? And by the way, for all the secular people living who are good givers, I know my family was, and I grew up in a secular home, and my mom, I think she tithed better than most tithers, and she was a lapsed Catholic who hadn't gone to church almost her entire adult life.
Yeah. Well, this whole idea of going in and serving people of need has to be re-examined. Most of the work we do could be better done by locals on site. I was talking with a Nicaraguan banker some time ago who went into micro-lending, you know, little loans for peasant people to help build up their businesses. And I was asking him how he worked with the churches in Nicaragua, and he said that there are whole sections of his country where he can't do any micro lending at all. He said my people say, why do we want to borrow money? These American church partners give it to us. He said, why do we want to borrow money to build a church? They build it for us. And then Juan said, they are turning my people into beggars. And so that's the kind of impact that we inadvertently are causing in our attempt to help.
So we're not thinking in that old axiom, teach a man to fish.
That's right.
We're sort of ignoring this. And again, this is a deep biblical principle. Why aren't more business leaders engaged in this kind of work? Because it sounds like, if anything, that's what we need. But then again, to your point before, if a business leader comes in and he's competing against free, well, it's impossible. And by the way, I have this argument with my friends who are progressives in this country. Free is hard to compete with, but free is really bad.
Oh, free is very disempowering. Business people can have a very positive redemptive impact is if they go in and actually start for-profit businesses that make money with the poor. I have a friend here from Atlanta that was made his living importing Pier 1 type stuff from the Pacific Rim. And he had trouble with quality control, timely shipping. So he said, I can do this better myself. So he and his wife moved to the Philippines, and he opened up a factory there and started manufacturing these household goods. That was 10 years ago. I saw him at a Christmas party this last year and asked him how his business was going. And he said that he had 3,000 people employed. And so I said, that must really be changing the area. And he said, oh yeah, it is. It's probably created 3,000 auxiliary jobs around his businesses. And he said they do profit sharing. They have health care for all their workers. They have daycare for their workers. And so it has dramatically impacted a poverty culture and given folks a whole new lease on life. They've planted three churches, and so here's a man with an entrepreneurial spirit who wants to do good as well as do well, and it's transforming a whole culture. Well, it would take, you send 50 missionaries into the same place for 50 years, and you wouldn't accomplish the same kind of positive impact that one committed businessman can do using his God-given ability to create wealth. So the business people are very much needed as the new missionaries on the field.
Yeah, but they don't.
If we want to change poverty.
Yeah, we don't need their money. We need their talent. We need their We need their investment, which is a very different thing than a gift.
Absolutely. Yep. It's creating jobs. It's enabling folks to use their abilities, their hard work, to take measured steps to move out of poverty situation into what I would call shalom, sense of peace, prosperity, well-being, community, which I believe is God's desire for all of us.
You know, when I have these conversations with folks I really love, my pastor, others, and I talk about capitalism and how important it is that we people of faith, and you know, and there it is, the parable of the talents. So there it is in the word. What we do with our money, do we hide it? Do we put it out into the world? Well, what capitalists do is they take that capital, they put it out into the world. They don't hoard it, they don't spend it on themselves. Why are people of faith so resistant to this thing called capitalism? And the two go hand in hand so beautifully. Look what it's produced here in this country.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I think one of the reasons why we don't hear messages that reinforce the importance of wealth creation is because our pastors have gone to seminaries rather than business schools. They don't understand how business and the market works. I've talked to many very wealthy business people, and to the person they have said, my church just doesn't understand me, or my pastor doesn't understand me. They warn against the dangers of wealth, the seductiveness of mammon, but don't ever preach that wealth creation is a spiritual gift under the lordship of Christ, being able to create wealth, which is to say, create jobs that enable a society to flourish. They don't see that as a godly thing, nor do they celebrate those that have that gift of wealth creation.
But, no doubt.
But it is certainly biblical.
No doubt. And we're talking to Bob Lupton, his new book, Charity Detox, What Charity Would Look Like If We Cared About Results. And we'll finish up our conversation after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're closing out this hour, and it's a terrific hour, the conversation with Bob Lupton. We're interviewing him on his new book, Charity Detox, What Charity Would Look Like If We Cared About Results. And Bob, where we left off is I'd wanted to ask you about this thing called microlending, because it's everywhere. You know, Muhammad Yanis won a Nobel Prize for this idea, and it's very popular amongst what I would call the NGO crowd. Talk about why you're not a big fan of microlending, and what are its deficiencies?
Well, microlending are small loans to peasant people to help them increase the size of their businesses. It may be a little loan to help a woman buy a little bit more fruit to sell in her stand, or a mother to buy another treadle sewing machine so She and her daughter can both sew garments to sell. And so micro-lending is very important to enable folks to live at a better survival level. And so micro-lending is helpful. But micro-lending does not move people out of poverty. It doesn't create wealth. And in order to create wealth, in order for people to thrive, we know this in our own business climate, a business has to come to scale. That means that it's more than just what I can produce with my own hands in one day. I have to have others working for me. I have to mechanize. I have to streamline. So a business has to grow in order to create wealth and make and employ more people. Well, micro loans do not enable people to move from cottage industry into full scale business. And the reason why is if their business grows, it comes onto the radar screen of the government. These small businesses, micro enterprises, are a part of an informal economy. So that means they don't pay taxes, they don't register with the government. But as soon as they get larger, they do have to do that, and which means they've got to fill out a lot more government forms and be mechanized and worry about marketing and packaging and health.
The health care.
Yeah, making sure that their product is safe,
yeah.
Which governments require. Well, in order to do that, it's a quantum leap for someone that has a little fruit stand to move into a full-fledged business. And so what they need in order to become, to actually create wealth, are the kinds of talents that we have in our pews. Those are the business people that run businesses, and we do it better than anybody else in the world. We call it SMEs, small medium enterprises, and that makes up 80% of the new jobs that we create every year in this society. It's 50% of the GNP. So we do it very well. We just haven't been using that talent to enable peasants in a struggling country to develop those talents so that their businesses can grow beyond micro into SMEs. So that calls forth a whole different kind of missionary. That is business as mission, and if we're going to alleviate poverty, our Christian business people are going to have to engage in the process.
Now, Bob, in Charity Detox, you movingly tell John Coors' story. And I think the most important lesson from that story was his humility. I mean, it really moved us over here in our studio about what he was doing wrong, a humility that is hard for actually any human being to admit to himself, but a humility we must all bring into this discussion if we truly care about the poor. Share it with us, John Coors' story,
well,
if you can.
Well, John Coors is a fine Christian man, has been very successful, and he had the idea that there are whole sections of this world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, that just have, there's no electric grid at all, so they live on fires that they collect and cook and heat over. And he came up with a strategy to provide very, very inexpensive energy, kind of propane tanks, that would allow people to have light in their homes and be able to cook without the health problems that smoky wood creates. That idea seemed like a good one. And he implemented that in many villages, but over time realized that as soon as their propane tank ran out, they didn't come to refill it. They went back to gathering and burning sticks. And so John realized that the only way that this dream, he called it circles of light, the only way that it could grow would be if you were going to subsidize it. And as a businessman, he said, no, subsidizing folks does not make them strong and independent. And so he pulled the plug on that, which was a very courageous thing to do. And so he said, what people need are jobs. And so he has changed his whole strategy, is going after other wealthy families to partner with African entrepreneurs who have good business skills but just don't have the capital and the connections to enable their businesses to thrive. And so he's using his influence to develop those kind of partnerships that will enable African businesses to thrive, which means that they will create jobs, which is the only way people move out of poverty.
No doubt. And let's talk about, in closing out this discussion, you know, obviously there's capital, and we all know that kind of capital, and that's money. And what people are looking for in the for-profit world is a return on capital. And that's a word called profit, which generates all kinds of accountability and a great standard and system of measurement. We in America, well, at least most of us, understand how important profit is and capital. But let's talk about the human kind of capital. And I think that's the capital that matters most in the 21st century. You need the capital, that's the money. But without human capital, what do you got? Talk about that.
Well, what we have in this country in abundance is not only know-how in how to run successful businesses. We have motivation and access to monetary capital, and so better than anybody else in the world, our entrepreneurial ability enables us to thrive. That's personal capital. We also know how to hire well, how to train well, how to retain a workforce, have a healthy workforce. We know how to do all those things. What is missing in developing worlds are you call them the missing middle. There's a whole large segment of people who are scratching out a living just in micro businesses, and then there's a small band of wealth at the top. In Nicaragua, it's 11 families that control about 90% of the wealth of the country. So that's typical of developing countries. So what we have is we've got the wealth of ability and know-how and experience that if we bring it into those developing countries, we can have a profound effect on helping folks move economically, socially, spiritually out of poverty.
I'm going to leave with one quick question. If you could give us about a minute on this, Bob, this idea of re-neighboring. What is re-neighboring?
Re-neighboring is deciding that the most effective way to end poverty in a community is to end the isolation, which means that we as committed people, committed to be neighbors, particularly among those in need, actually relocate and become neighbors in places of need and join with folks that are struggling. And from the inside of the environment, we work to effect positive change. That more than any other single strategy in this country is a poverty alleviator that changes neighborhoods when committed, caring, capable, connected people become neighbors.
Well, Bob Lupton, thanks so much for this book. We'd love to have you on regularly. We do a lot of talk about generosity in this country because there is tremendous amounts. But we have to talk about efficacy and effectiveness, too. Thanks for your book, Charity Detox, and thanks for spending the hour with us.
Nice to be with you.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And you can go to ouramericannetwork.org to hear this and everything we do.
day I am your champion. I may have won your hearts, but I know the game, you forget my name, and I won't be here in another year if I don't stay on the charts.
This is Lee Habib, and you're opening up this show today with Billy Joel's The Entertainer, because today we're celebrating the life of an entertainer, Chris Farley, born on this day in history in 1964. And my goodness, what an entertainer he was. And Billy's song is a lament about the pressures of being an entertainer, staying on top and then everybody forgetting about you. And so many of these entertainers' stories end poorly. Too many, sadly. And we wanted to celebrate this man's life because he made so many of us laugh. Born in Madison, Wisconsin, his father, Thomas, owned an oil company. His mother, Mary Ann, a housewife. He had four siblings, Tom Jr., Kevin, John, and Barbara. His cousin, Jim, is the CEO and chairman at the Ford Motor Company of Europe. And today, Chris would have been 52 years old, but he passed away as a result of a drug overdose of cocaine and morphine at the age of 33 on December 18th, 1997. He checked into rehab 17 times before his death. What a struggle. And we all have family members who engaged in this same struggle. So always be praying for and pulling for these folks, because it's all of us. We wanted to pull some clips from the documentary I Am Chris Farley. We got a pretty good glimpse into the life of this man and the people around him. Here we hear from some of his siblings about what their dad was like and some of the shenanigans Chris would play while growing up.
My dad was a great guy. He was a salesman. Just hilarious. I mean, it wasn't a house where, you know, dad was strict or anything like that. And he'd get home and watch the news and then, you know, stir us all up into some kind of frenzy. And then somebody get hurt. And then he'd go, all right, that's it all. You took it too far. And he started the whole thing. He liked to have the chaos.
Our family dinner table, Chris had a presence. He loved to be the entertainer, for sure.
Well, there was a lot of competition that way on who could do the funniest thing. He usually won most of the time. He just demanded it. We were probably in fourth grade, and we had a bus that went across town, and he would sing, Jeremiah was a bullfrog. Jeremiah was a bullfrog. And he'd have the whole bus standing up singing it. He took his shirt off for that on the school bus and just sang it in the front.
I liked a girl named Chris Bear, and so he would be in the back of the bus going, Johnny Farley loves Chris Bear naked. Johnny Farley. He got the whole bus to chant it, and I was in the front going, oh, why?
In grade school at St. Patrick's, my mom was in the semicircle with a bunch of nuns around it, and they were saying, you know, the students at school are laughing at Christopher, not with him.
And obviously, Farley's family, a traditional Roman Catholic family, and Irish. From the documentary on the life of Farley, we hear from comedians Bob Saget and Bob Odenkirk about that dark side that Chris had, like so many other funny people, suffer with.
He's a very sweet guy. Before midnight, he was as open and like a six-year-old as he was dark. And the darkness was compelling, but not something you want to really be around.
When he would get super messed up, he would pull away a little bit. Everybody's on my ass. I'll be by myself. I got the exact drugs I'm going to do, and then I'm going to get it together, which is just not the way it goes. The way it goes, you get messed up, then you really, you know, you call your buddies.
When you're jumping up steps in the showbiz ladder, and you're leaping over everyone around you, and everyone around you is going, you better watch out. Some part of you has to be going, no, you better watch out, because I'm kicking ass every day.
And here is some classic Chris Farley from SNL in his Matt Foley motivational speaker sketch, where he lectures two teenagers, played by David Spade and Christina Applegate, after they were caught smoking something funny.
My name is Matt Foley, and I am a motivational speaker. Now let's get started by letting me give you a little bit of a scenario of what my life is all about. First off, I am 35 years old, I am divorced, and I live in a van down by the river. Now you kids are probably saying to yourselves, hey, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get the world by the tail and wrap it around and pull it down and put it in my pocket. Well, I'm here to tell you that you're probably going to find out as you go out there that you're not going to amount to jack squat. You're going to end up eating a steady diet of government cheese and living in a van down by the river. Now, young man, what do you want to do with your life?
Actually, Matt, I kind of want to be a writer.
Well, la-dee frickin' duh! We got ourselves a writer here!
Well, here Chris Farley's friend and fellow actor Peter Finn recites a prayer that he and Chris would pray before the auditions that were about asking the Lord for the ability to create more laughter than tears.
It's called a clown's prayer. And before any audition at Second City or for TV or film, we'd always take out the prayer and we'd read it. I still have the prayer in my wallet. I usually don't read prayers, but I will. I mean, I do, but not for... All right. Dear Lord, as I stumble through this life, help me to create more laughter than tears, dispense more happiness than gloom, spread more cheer than despair. Never let me become so blasé that I will fail to see the wonder in the eyes of a child or the twinkle in the eyes of the aged. Never let me forget that my work is to cheer people, make them happy, and make them laugh. Never let me acquire success to the point where I discontinue calling on my Creator in the hour of need and acknowledging Him and thanking Him in the hour of plenty. And in my final moment, may I hear you whisper, when you made my people smile, you made me smile.
Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Chris Farley. Born today, this day in history.
There ought to be clowns. Well, maybe next
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. In this feature, you're going to hear about and meet someone you've definitely heard of, but likely don't truly know.
An escaped slave and leading abolitionist, orator and newspaper publisher, Union Army recruiter, diplomat and advisor to presidents, Frederick Douglass was without a doubt one of the great voices for human freedom. Born in February 1818 to a slave mother and white father who was his master, many today simply celebrate his birth month.
I have no accurate knowledge of my age, never having seen any authentic record containing it. By far the larger part of the slaves know as little of their ages as horses know of theirs, and it is the wish of most masters within my knowledge to keep their slaves thus ignorant. I do not remember to have ever met a slave who could tell of his birthday. Frederick Douglass, 1845.
Google celebrates Douglass every year by posting a picture of the lion-haired icon on the front page of their search engine. Here's historian William Gwaltney.
Frederick Douglass was certainly very striking as to his appearance. An aquiline nose, very piercing, wide-set eyes, a very strong chin. And he was a tall man, about 6 feet, 2 inches, broad-shouldered, muscular, a man who, in fact, attempted to maintain himself in a strong and forceful appearance.
We know what Douglas stood against, but what did he stand for? Here's David Blight, author of Frederick Douglass's Civil War, giving us a nutshell description of Douglass.
Douglass's life sort of stands across the expanse of the 19th century as a symbol of the worst and the best in the American character. He was the slave who saw most of the worst brutalities of slavery. He was the slave, however, who freed himself and by luck, pluck, and gifts remade himself. Most importantly, he had an enormous ability to capture in words the meaning of what America is about.
But what American meaning did he specifically capture? What did he see America being about that led him to fight these battles and stand for these causes? His core convictions go far beyond his opposition to slavery. Douglass was a relentless advocate for individual rights, whether speaking of blacks, women, Native Americans, or immigrants. Equally important, Douglass knew that government power posed a threat to those rights. Douglass understood that the proper role of government was to protect individual rights and guarantee equality before the law, not to dispense favors to this group or that. For example, in his famous April 1865 speech, What the Black Man Wants, Douglass declared, "The American people have always been anxious to know what they shall do with us. I have had but one answer from the beginning: do nothing with us. If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall. All I ask is give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Let him alone." Douglass's message was not just about African Americans. Rather, it offers a stinging rebuke to all those who believe that men and women cannot be the masters of their own fates. The freedom that Douglass agitated for was not the freedom of the welfare state. Simply providing for people's material needs was not a substitute for giving them their freedom. Besides, doing for all too easily morphed into doing to, an opportunity to do mischief, as he put it. He knew that, as President Gerald Ford once said, "A government big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you have." He strongly believed in limited government, claiming there was no governmental authority to pass laws nor compel obedience to any laws that are against the natural rights and happiness of men. Here's John Marsalek, professor of history at Mississippi State.
I think it's fair to say that in many ways he's the conscience of the nation in this instance.
Moreover, Douglass understood that economic liberty was a crucial component of liberty more generally. He believed in private property and the accumulation of wealth. When a speaker from the Rhode Island Anti-Slavery Society compared wage slavery to chattel slavery, Douglass declared such sentiments to be arrant nonsense and argued forcefully, "So far from being a sin to accumulate property, it is the plain duty of every man to lay up something for the future." He rejected class warfare, saying, "I have no sympathy for the narrow, selfish notion of economy, which assumes that every crumb of bread which goes into the mouth of one class is so much taken from the mouths of another class." And while acknowledging the imperfections of capitalism in practice, he nonetheless saw it as the best engine for both individual betterment and economic progress. As for the redistribution of wealth, Douglass warned, "The non-producers now receive the larger share of what those who labor produce. The result is natural. Discontent culminates in exactly the same ratio that intelligence sustains aspiration." In fact, many modern historians have accused Douglass of having a pro-capitalist bias, in the words of the University of Virginia's Waldo Martin. Yale's David Blight criticizes Douglas for preaching laissez-faire individualism. Perhaps. Certainly Douglas would have had no use for today's Leviathan state that tells people how to save for their retirement, what health insurance to buy, what charities to support, what to eat, or whom they can marry. He would have been shocked by a government from which roughly 60% of Americans receive more in benefits than they pay to it in federal taxes. This passionate advocate of achievement through education would have been appalled by a system that puts the interests of teachers above those of students and forces parents to continue sending their children to failing schools. And the man who preached thrift and wrote, "I had a wholesome dread of the consequences of running in debt," would have certainly opposed the profligacy that's produced our $16.7 trillion national debt. A picture of Douglas on Google's front page is a great way to get us to ask, who is that? But an even better tribute would be for a few more Americans to know what this great man said and what beliefs drove him to advance the causes he stood for. Frederick Douglass. This Day in History.
Great job on that, Greg. And as always, This Day in History brought to us by Hillsdale College. And Frederick Douglass gave two speeches there. He spoke at Hillsdale in 1863 on January 21st, which just happens to be my birthday. Not 1863, January 21st. And the speech was called Popular Error and Unpopular Truth. And there's no transcript, regrettably. And he spoke again on September 27th, 1888, Hillsdale College, a deep connection with this man. As a child, Douglass was exposed to a number of religious sermons, and in his youth, he became interested in literacy. He began reading and copying Bible verses, and he eventually became a Christian. He shared his testimony in his last biography, The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, and here's what he wrote. "I was not more than 13 years old when in my loneliness and destitution I longed for someone to whom I could go as to a father and protector. The preaching of a white Methodist minister named Hansen was the means of causing me to feel that in God I had such a friend. He thought that all men, great and small, bond and free, were sinners in the sight of God, that they were by nature rebels against his government, and that they must repent of their sins and be reconciled to God through Christ. I cannot say that I had a very distinct notion of what was required of me, but one thing I did know well, I was wretched and had no means of making myself otherwise." So we learn about Frederick Douglass and take a listen to our special on Dr. Martin Luther King, whom we didn't call doctor once. We called him Reverend King over and over again. And how the secular world strips these men of faith of their faith. And here at Our American Stories, we put it right back in, where it belongs. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Frederick Douglass. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And it's time for our Wall Street Journal story of the day. And we believe the journal is America's journal. And so much of the reporting there is so good. And today's piece is called Fishermen on the Hook to Pay for Their Own Regulators. And it's written by a lifelong New England fisherman named David Gaethel. And David graduated from Boston University with a degree in biology, but no ivory tower could keep him away from what he's been doing since he was 13, what he was born to do, being out in the open water. As if the ocean didn't present enough challenges, now the federal government, his own government, might put David and almost all of his fellow fishermen out of business by forcing them to pay the cost of enforcing the government's own regulations. David, thanks so much for joining us.
It's nice to be here.
You bet. And, you know, you heard a little bit of that Billy Joel song coming in. It's one of my favorite songs of his. And I don't think that Billy had in mind what we were about to talk to today, but he was writing about the struggles of fishermen to make do out on Long Island, where housing costs just kept going up and the local fishermen out there just couldn't afford to live in the places they used to live. But talk about, before we start, tell us a bit about what you and your peers are doing. What do you do every day? Tell us a little bit about your life before we get into some of the struggles you're facing with your own government, David.
Yes, well, I tow a net on the bottom to catch fish, which I bring home every day to sell, and the money from the sale of those fish feeds my family. So basically my day starts at 4:30 in the morning. I meet my crew at the dock, and if I have one of these federal observers, I meet them as well. We go out, we fish for anywhere from 6 to 10 hours, and then we return to port, unload the fish, and the fish are mixed with other fishermen's fish from my fishing cooperative. And those fish are then sold into the white tablecloth markets throughout the Northeast.
And you are not, you know, this is obviously not some giant commercial operation, and yet it's not recreation. I mean, this is your
That's
life.
Right. We're small boats. I have a 44-foot boat. There isn't a boat in New Hampshire, that's the state I'm from, that's over 50 feet in length. So these are small, what we call day boats. They leave early in the morning, and they don't stay out for more than a day, and they come home and unload their catch in the evening.
And your 44-foot trawler is the Ellen Diane.
That's correct, named after my wife.
Yep. And so what are you fishing for out there, mostly?
Well, we fish for a variety of things, but mostly we fish for what are called ground fish, which are a mixture of a number of different species, things like cod, haddock, flounders. Those would be the ones probably most familiar to your listeners. But we catch about 30 or 40 different species all mixed together and all with different regulations.
And so as we learned, I guess, and I, obviously your life is not the Bering Strait, so it's not Deadliest Catch, but what I really do love about that show is that people learn that, boy, you can go out and maybe you catch something and maybe you don't. And there isn't anybody to bail you out when you don't catch it. Talk about that if you can.
Well, that's correct. I mean, this is fishing, not catching. If it was catching, it would be pretty boring.
That's
if you just
true.
Went out and threw the net in and knew exactly what you were going to catch every day. Somebody likened it to, counting trees in the forest, except you don't know how big the forest is and you can't see the trees. So there's an element of chance, but there's also very much an element of skill. Fish are not randomly distributed in the ocean. They're very patchily distributed in relatively high concentrations, and you learn this over time.
Yeah, and the talent for fishing is not randomly and evenly distributed. It is randomly distributed and not evenly distributed, as you well know, David. Tell me this. You intimated it before, but so some days you go out and it's not a good day. Some days you go out, it is a good day, but now you got to bring that haul back, and you got to sell it fast. So talk about that. Talk about the perishability of what you're catching, and talk about the market, because some days the market might fetch more money than others.
Yeah, that's correct. I think an old wag once said, fish and company both smell after 3 days. and it's very true. I mean, they don't get any fresher. We sell the very freshest you can get, fish that are literally sometimes less than an hour old when they landed. But they still have a fixed market life, and they have to be sold. And they're sold at auctions across New England. There are three or four of them. And the prices vary every day. It's, based more or less on supply and demand. The reason I say more or less is because there's a lot of fish imported into the United States. We currently import 91% of the of the seafood we eat, and that affects the price, and that's external to what we catch. So it makes it a little bit difficult to figure out how much you're going to make.
So already there are so many things that you can't control, and yet, and I think a lot of people are listening going, my goodness, you had a biology degree, and yet you started in this life at 13, and my only explanation can be is this is not only what you're really good at, but David, this is what you love and what you want to do the rest of your life.
That's right. I mean, this is you know, I enjoy my job. Every day I get up, I've been doing this for almost 50 years, and I can't wait to go the next day the weather's good. We're currently in the middle of a northeaster here, and it's snowing out and quite windy. But as soon as it calms down, I'll be back on the ocean. And, you know, what we see every day is what a lot of people pay money on their vacations to see. I mean, we see whales jumping. We see the sunrise every day. We see an assortment of seabirds. We're very much in touch with nature.
Yeah, and you can't get you can't get compensation for that. That's what you call the bonus plan. So let's talk about you and other fishermen. And you go out every day, and you got to take enough fish to meet your needs, but yet you've got to leave enough for the fish populations to stay healthy. Talk about that balance that has to get struck as you go out every day doing what you do.
Yes, I mean, if there's not a sustainable fishery, there won't be sustainable fishermen. And so there is very much a balance here, and we've learned over my lifetime that balance is not as high as it used to be. That, for example, you can't take 50 or 60% of a stock of fish year after year after year. They just can't support that. It's basically what you call surplus production is what you can harvest, and that seems to run somewhere around 20 to 25% depending on the species. So, you know, we have to have some controls on both the number of fishermen and their effort. The question then becomes, how do you control that, and how much oversight do you have to have? I mean, do you just assume everybody on the planet is a crook and you have to treat them like that, or do you assume that most of the people are very honest people and you just need some random spot checks to keep them that way?
Well, and what's going on right now? Because there are multiple agencies and methods to manage fisheries, keeping the catches low enough that they don't deplete the stock and leave too little or nothing for next year or next decade. But talk about what that next level too far has been for you and your brothers and sisters out on the field. And really short here, because we're going to come back on the break. If you can, just about 30 seconds right now, then hold that thought and we'll be back. Or in fact, you know what? Why don't we just hold it right there? And this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're talking to a guy who's been out in the sea most of his life, since he was 13. His name is David Gathel. And his story in the Wall Street Journal, Fishermen on the Hook to Pay for Their Own Regulators, well, it caught our attention. And where public policy hits the road, or in this place, in this particular instance, where it hits the sea, where it hits the water, that's where we want to be on Our American Stories. And again, this is Lee Habib. OurAmericanNetwork.org is where you can find this if you're not hearing it when you want or when you can in the car. You can always go up on our website and catch what you missed. And we'll be back with more from David and more about his own struggles with his own government. And this is Our American Stories, and we're talking to fisherman David Gathel, and we're talking about his story that was featured in the Wall Street Journal, Fishermen on the Hook to Pay for Their Own Regulators. We learned a bit about David's life in the sea, and now we're going to learn about some of the obstacles he's facing, and one in particular. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, nice to be here.
So things have changed. And even though there are many layers of regulations in place, the feds and the federal regulators who look into your business and want to protect, obviously, the fishing stock itself, you think there's been a bridge too far here. What's going on, and why does it concern you and so many of your, again, your brothers and sisters who fish out in the sea?
Yes, well, currently we're monitored in a number of different ways. For example, the Coast Guard can stop by any time and search your entire boat. They have warrantless search. The state fish and game agencies can do the same thing. The boat has a satellite tracking device that transmits to the government 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I like to call it an ankle bracelet for the boat, even though the boat's never done anything wrong. In addition to that, they have uniformed NOAA federal agents and plainclothes people that may be on the dock when you get in. So it's not as though we're not monitored. In addition to that, they have biological monitors that they pay for on all fishing trips to go out and collect basic biological data that feeds into the stock assessments. And I don't think any of us have a problem with any of that. Sometimes it gets a little overbearing, but it's a function of government. It's paid for by government. In addition to that, they have what are called at-sea monitors, which the way I describe them to people is imagine that you have to register with the government 2 days in advance before you go to work, and on 1 day out of every five you go to work, somebody gets sent to your house, they inspect your car to see if it's safe for them to ride along in, and then they go with you down the highway to make sure you don't exceed the speed limit. Kind of like having your own personal state policeman to ride along with you on your way to work. And again, yep. The government's been paying for them. Now they say they don't have the money and they want us to pay for them. And the charge is $710 per day to go to work. That's bad enough, but consider that these companies that produce these monitors are for-profit companies. We have no say in the profits. And the largest of these companies is owned by a former NOAA assistant administrator. So if nothing else, there appears to be some crony capitalism here. And basically, this is going to sink us. I mean, I gross somewhere between $800 and $1,500 a day. Out of that, I have to pay for crew and all the expenses of owning and operating a vessel. And you take another $710 out of that, and it's pretty easy to see that we start coming up with days where we get a bill for leaving to go to work for 15 hours.
Yep. And by the way, NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And you're essentially saying that they want to force you to pay for sea monitors who are actually contractors. And basically, you got to cover the contractor's fee. And the person, one of the contracting companies, is owned by a former head of NOAA itself.
That's correct.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Now, what are you doing about it? What's happening? What's the next phase here for you? How do you fight this? Obviously, you are, but what are the mechanics? What happened next? I mean, there was this is a bridge too far for you. You just can't foot this bill.
Well, we've been fighting it since we were told it was going to happen. They've pushed the date back now four different times in the last year, but it started with basically a grassroots campaign. You know, we wrote to our senators and our congressmen. They, in turn, in a fit of bipartisanship, wrote to NOAA Fisheries and said, fix this problem. NOAA responded a few months later basically saying, no, we're not going to fix it. It kind of escalated from there, and, more and more strident letters from Congress to the executive branch, you know, the Department of Commerce here, which is NOAA, saying you have to fix this. And they continue to say, no, we don't have the money. The fishermen are going to have to pay. And, oh, by the way, it's voluntary. And our response is, yeah, it's voluntary. That you voluntarily pay $710 a day or you can't leave the pier. That's kind of like saying it's voluntary to go to the concentration camp. You have a choice. You can be shot on the spot or you can march. A group called Cause of Action in Washington, which is a government accountability nonprofit, read about this in the newspapers. I've been giving interviews to the newspapers and to radio stations, and they said, we think this is illegal, and they had a number of reasons for that, and so they have filed suit on my behalf against NOAA Fisheries.
Well, and what's remarkable here is that making generally, you know, the people being regulated aren't the ones that pay the bill. The U.S. taxpayers are for these regulations because it's protecting the general taxpayer. The unusual nature of this is that they're forcing you to pay for the monitors that are on your ship. That's, it's preposterous, David.
Well, I mean, I think it is. I think this is what you pay taxes for. It's a function of government. And in one of the letters to the editor that I wrote, I pointed out that Big Pharmacy doesn't pay for the Food and Drug Administration, that meat inspection is not paid for by farmers, and that the airlines don't pay for the Transportation Safety Authority. Those are all functions of government. They're paid for out of our taxes. And I would I further pointed out that, to me, forcing you to sign these contracts is a form of taxation without representation. It is NOAA Fisheries does not have taxing authority. Only Congress does. And yet they seem to be usurping the powers of Congress.
You know, I think, David, in the end, so much of what's going on in our country right now is about exactly that. I mean, Congress is the one that, you know, is Article 1 of our Constitution. And whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, well, Article 1 is Article 1. And that gives the people the power to say yes or no to taxes that are passed by our elected representatives. But who's Noah? I never heard of him. And now they're taxing you, which means, say you could come up with this money. Well, what would you have to do? You'd have to pass along the cost. All of your fellow fishermen and women would have to pass the cost along to us anyway. So no matter what happens, it would be a tax.
Right, but we can't pass the cost along because, as I pointed out in the first segment, most of the seafood is already imported, and those people don't pay these kinds of taxes. So, you know, it would give them, obviously, a competitive advantage in the marketplace. And I also point out to people that if we lose this case, don't be surprised to walk in someday and find out the chicken suddenly costs $20 a pound.
You bet.
Because all of a sudden, the meat inspectors are being paid for by the chicken industry. And, they can pass the cost along because agriculture in this country feeds this country. There's some real serious public policy considerations here that we're fighting about.
And this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're speaking to David Gaethel, whose story was chronicled in a piece in the Wall Street Journal, Fishermen on the Hook to Pay for Their Own Regulators. And we learn early in this story in the last segment that David's been out in the seas, well, since he was 13. And though he could have done a lot with his life, he had a biology degree in Boston University, so he could have been working in an office somewhere and doing what he studied. But this is what he loved. And again, David, I want to dig into that daily take, because the cost is $750 per day for that monitor. Talk about how much it costs to go out into that sea every day, what you bring back, and what's left over.
Well, in general, on average, we take in between $800 and $1,500 a day. Out of that, we pay about $300 to lease fish from people who don't fish so we can catch their fish. We pay about $200 for fuel. And on average, the expenses for the vessel are about 50% of the remainder. And the crew and I split that other 50% after those first big expenses are taken off the top. So if we were to add in the $710 a day to pay for these observers, on every trip we make with those people on the boat, we will be going backwards.
Yep.
We will not cover our costs for leaving the dock for the day.
And again, the consequence for us is, well, you know, obviously so much of the fish is coming from overseas. So your point was, well, you know, that'll be the end of a lot of fisherman jobs here, and in comes the foreign competitors to just grab up the rest of the remaining market share. Your worry is that this could start to be used by some in the agriculture business to advantage themselves over others. So it's not just that this will destroy your job and all the fishermen jobs, David, but you worry about the consequences down the road too.
Yeah, I worry about the consequences for the country because basically this could become a way to circumvent the will of Congress. All these regulatory agencies all have regulation costs. And, if they decide all of a sudden they need more money for the bureaucracy, well, it's tough to get it out of Congress. Let's just charge the users. You know, let's say we're the EPA and we decide to to charge the sewage treatment plants in every town in the country for their own regulatory costs instead of paying for them out of our budget. That would be an unfunded increase in their budget without Congress ever having had a look at it. So I mean, this has the potential to be very, very serious for this country. It could lead to an unmitigated expansion of the federal government and of the federal government's powers without Congress directly being able to control it.
Well, David, thanks so much for joining us, and we're going to check back in with you in about a month or two and see what's happened. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, it's been nice to talk to you, listeners.
Same here, and this is Lee Habib, and what a story this is. David Gaethel's story, fishermen on the hook to pay for their own regulators, from the Wall Street Journal. These are the kind of stories we tell here on Our American Stories. Ordinary folks trying to do ordinary jobs being blocked by their own government. More after this.